Eric, welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Show.
Thank you, guys. I'm excited. And welcome to Helsinki also. Thanks for coming to my little slice of home here.
I was really excited to come out here. I remember when I got the email, I was just like, ooh, Helsinki. Like, yeah, I can make a trip out there.
It's awesome.
And it's lived up to everything I was expecting. It's a lot better than what I was expecting. It's absolutely beautiful out here. Very clean city. I've had a lot of great food, had some reindeer.
Yeah.
It's been good.
It's the good stuff. And you went to Riga before this, right?
Yeah.
And was that your first time there?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, what I liked about Riga is just there's not any tourists or anything in the city. It was kind of just like really low-key, beautiful, a lot of the bohemian style architecture and all that.
Yeah, the city center is really cute.
Yeah.
That conference is great too.
It's
the OG's OG conference.
Yeah, it's funny because I didn't even realize that. I'm still feel new to Bitcoin, and I didn't even know that Honey Badger had been going on for close to a decade now.
Yep.
It's wild.
Yeah, they've got their 10-year anniversary coming up in 2 years, I think. Max was saying 27.
Eighth year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty cool. Yeah, that's where my public Bitcoiner career started there back
cool.
in 2019.
Cool.
Brought 50 books in my hand luggage to give out.
Yeah.
and you wrote your book, The Seventh Property, 4 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And why don't you tell us a little about yourself? We can, wherever you want to start.
Yeah. In terms of my journey, it's everything started with economics for me. When I was younger, I was a poor student. I didn't like school or anything like that. The first thing that like really intellectually captured me was economics. And I've always kind of viewed it as more just the most quantifiable framework of philosophy that you can look at. And I've always big philosophical questions have always been interesting to me. And that was the first thing that really got me interested in learning, like reading a lot more as I was getting older. And when I went off to college, I knew I wanted to study finance and I was getting kind of my Keynesian education at the time. And I was lucky enough to have been introduced to like free market capitalism and some of that thinking. It was Milton Friedman's Freedom to Choose or Freedom in Capitalism book that first got me started on everything. And then, so I was getting my education and I was, reading stuff on the side over different breaks between school and, learning Hayek, learning others. And that just kept me based throughout all the education that helped me understand, there's alternative modes of thinking. And I was aware of the problems with central banking. I was very just nihilistic about it. I didn't view gold as a solution. And I worked in an area, my first job, second job out of college, but I started working in restructuring out of college, where we would effectively take control of like bankrupt companies or companies that are on the decline, and we would turn them around in some way, shape, or form. And then my second job is I worked for an investor that would be the ones actually buying them out and bring in guys like what I was formerly doing to take control of it. That was just something that I viewed as being... it's kind of like out of all of the alternative asset investing you can do, venture capital, private equity, hedge funds, things like that. Guys who do this strategy have been the best performing within that category historically. And it was something that because of my, economic philosophy of central banks are going to create boom and bust, and this is the type of thing that's always going to be profitable over the long term, is kind of my way of here's how you make money in the fiat economy. It wasn't like a conscious decision I ever actually made thinking about it from that perspective. But in hindsight, I was like, oh, that's basically what my reasoning was. And I was just doing that at the time. And then eventually I misunderstood Bitcoin for a long time because it was originally posed to me as blockchain technology. And so I apply, I'm like, okay, here's this technology. How do I invest in it? And you apply from like the financial perspective, a securities analysis framework, all the finance bros who are saying this doesn't have cash flows. That's what they're doing. They're looking at it like it's a security, which is supposed to have some sort of distribution of cash flow to it to have value. And, so I applied that framework. I said, well, it doesn't produce any cash flow. I wasn't against it. I just was like, this is something that I don't know how to value, and it's not the type of investing that I do. And it wasn't until it was like, no, it was some sort of like Reddit post or something that I came across back in like, it was around like 2016, 2017 that was saying like, this is an alternative to central banking. And then that got me very interested. I was like, oh, well, that's a problem I'm aware of. And I've certainly learned tenfold since I got involved in Bitcoin. You think you have an understanding of issues and then you learn a lot more once you get involved in the industry. And that's what started me down my whole journey. So eventually I got to a point when I was working for the private equity fund, when I was just like, is this what I want to do? And I was just like, well, I'm not in love with it. I always knew I wanted to do something I was in love with. And then just like this crazy thought started festering in my mind. Like, what if you do something in Bitcoin? Like, that's all you think about. It's all you read about. You know, this is your, what's capturing my intellectual curiosity. And then eventually I was like, all right, let's do it. I quit my job, sold my place, moved back home, started working on writing the book, The Seventh Property. That kind of got me started in the industry. And then I think through all that, I just realized that I was like, okay, so what's in my mind a way that I can help Bitcoin given what I used to do and what's really needed? And I think it's Bitcoin's, you know, I think the addressable market for gold, Bitcoin being able to consume all that, like that's done, that's going to happen. And the question becomes what else needs to be built to help this become freedom money over time? And that's when I think investing in Bitcoin companies and infrastructure around Bitcoin is really important. And that was the logic of wanting to start Epoch, the venture capital fund idea that's investing in like seed stage companies that are, you know, trying to promote that vision in some way, shape, or form. Really, like our philosophy is we want Bitcoin to be adopted as much as possible and build things that make that easier for Bitcoin.
Yeah, super cool. You mentioned Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek.
Yeah.
So before you started writing the book, had you done a deeper deep dive into Austrian economics already at that point?
Or? Yeah, I just been, you know, I was introduced to Hayek and Mises somewhat early on. Yeah. I hadn't, you know, comprehensively read everything they'd done, but I understood a lot of their thinking and theories. I intuitively always aligned with that mode of thinking. And I think that's what's interesting about once you kind of get a little bit into Austrian, you learn a few things and then you just start to fill in the gaps yourself.
Yeah.
Because it's a framework of thinking. And that's kind of where I was, I'd say, is I understood this mode of thinking. I understood that at a fundamental level that Keynesian ideologies are just people attempting to quantify things that you can't quantify and over-engineer things that you shouldn't be touching in the first place. And that was kind of my framework.
Now, the thing I really loved about that book is that it went deep into the economic philosophy of Bitcoin, but it also had a very technical part in, towards the end, right? It actually explained how the time chain works.
Yeah.
And a little deeper of a deep dive than many other
Bitcoin books. That was a big goal of mine. And the logic was basically, because the only Bitcoin book that I'd read was The Bitcoin Standard. And I think it's a great book. And that was a big part of me understanding some aspects of monetary history. But from the world that I came from, like a partner at a private equity fund who doesn't really care about freedom and wants to make money, it's like, what sells these people? And these people control a lot of money. And Bitcoin's for everyone. And I was just like, and they're very serious about how they look at things. And they're very like pragmatic, usually. Like theory is not something that they care much for. They want to see like, you know, tangible data. And like some of the best things that we can look at is history. You know, history is kind of that version of it for the expanse of what's happened with money over time. And a good example, that's like Ray Dalio in his book of long-term debt cycles. Like that's something that's a very practical way of showing here's tangible points as to why these things happen over the long term. And that was kind of my goal for the book was to say, I wanted to be as measured as I could, which is hard to do because to like write comprehensively about these things is impossible. You end up creating, you know, a book like Mises would write
that's
this thick and it's better used as a weapon. Like, you have to like pick a side basically. You have to say, here's what we're going to focus on in this text. And, I wanted to be technical, because I wanted to have this like view that's I'm trying to approach this from a pragmatic standpoint. I want to be measured in how I'm assessing it. And in the same way that I would always understand investments, you know, in my prior job, it's we got to look under the hood, you know, we got to look at every detail, we have to exhaust it. And I wanted to apply that same mode of thinking when I was trying to understand Bitcoin. And I just really didn't have a background in computer science. Like, we'd looked at investments that we're looking at a semiconductor company to buy one time. And, you know, that helped me get a little bit familiar with how chips are manufactured, and which is really cool. It's like probably the coolest form of manufacturing in the world. For me to understand something, it's like, I got to look at every detail. And I was like, okay, so like, I got to look at how Bitcoin works. And then basically I was like, okay, what are all the books I can read? And there was like, you know, Mastering Bitcoin. And then there was Programming Bitcoin by Jimmy Song. And I was like, I don't know how to code or anything. So I taught myself like a very basic understanding of how to code so I can read the language and get through the book. And getting through that gave me such a good understanding of like how it works mechanically. And I think that was really, really important. Like, I didn't realize it as much at the time. It was just like a natural intuition to understand it. But in hindsight, it was really important because people debate things all the time. And I think if you just like understand the mechanics of Bitcoin, it's a lot easier to have your own perspective on things. I don't understand everything, but there's a lot of things where I'm kind of like, I don't know if I necessarily buy that because I understand how this works, you know? So that was my goal, to basically take what I learned from that I had to like learn how to code to do, and simplify it for the finance bro so that I can be like, here's still a technical deep dive into it, but I can kind of translate some of these things from computer science to the finance professional.
Yeah, because Jimmy's book is very complicated.
It is complicated. Yeah.
It's not for anyone.
It took me a while. Yeah.
It's not for everyone. It's for someone. Mm-hmm. Are you working on another book?
Yeah, it's, you know, the logic that, when I wrote, I wasn't planning on being an author, right? Like, when I quit my job and got in on all of this, to me, it was just, I wanted to understand Bitcoin as best as I could. And that led me just to, you know, read all these different things. And that led me, and then it just turned into me being like, I want to read all these areas of economic history I've never had the time to read. And you just, I basically spent 9-10 months just like reading whatever my curiosity was looking for. And going through that process, and I was like, okay, well, I've read so much, like, I know that a good way to understand things is to write it out. And I started writing, like, I just started writing, and then I was like, okay, I can make this like a series of blog posts or something to be like my core understanding of Bitcoin. And then I started writing so much, I was like, okay, this is basically going to be a book. And then I learned, how do you, you know, create a book, and how do you publish a book, and all of that. And I was like, I guess it's, anybody can do this. So I guess I'll turn it into a book. And it kind of happened like that. And I think the reason I did it is just because it seemed like there was a need for it in the market. Like, I felt like I kind of have something to say about this that I'm not hearing anywhere else. And it just seemed, it made a ton of sense at the time. I haven't felt that since. Like, I haven't had that intuition or feeling. I think that if I do, then I would write another book. But it's not something I've planned on. And we'll see. Maybe I'm a one and done. I don't know.
So, how has your view of Bitcoin changed since you wrote the book?
That's a great question. I've gotten a lot deeper into my perspectives on the infrastructure around Bitcoin and what that looks like. And, you know, at risk of getting too technical on anything, let me know if I am. But I think that with... There's these fundamental trade-offs, right, that people who were building technologies in crypto were encountering. And because of these fundamental trade-offs, it's effectively created this race to the bottom within crypto, where they wanted to create an alternative form of money, and they wanted to do it in a decentralized way. And the reality that's unfolding now is we're seeing they're not creating alternative forms of money. They're just using a stable coin, and they're doing it in a centralized way. So like, those two visions really didn't pan out, and it's because the market really doesn't care as much about those things. They're kind of just demanding centralization for the use cases of the US dollar. And then the question is, well, what happens with Bitcoin? And we have things like the Lightning Network, and we have these other technologies that are emerging that people can use. And there are these fundamental trade-offs between, you know, user experience, efficiency of transactions, and just how, and the trust trade-offs that are required to use those technologies. And I think this whole vision of like keeping Bitcoin completely decentralized, providing layered protocols that have unilateral exit in all circumstances, is, I think it's certainly something that's going to be very achievable. I think it is achieved in a lot of ways today. The hard part is making these things competitive in a market against centralized technologies to people who have no vested interest within.
With these things, you mean like non-custodial wallets and so on?
Yeah. So like non-custodial wallet using the Lightning Network to make payments for like everyday use cases, or if they use some other technology other than Lightning, you know, whatever it is, having that experience be as comparable to a centralized ledger that a lot of people can use from an app that, you know, don't really care about freedom or trust trade-offs or anything. And that's the core of the issue. I think it's very achievable. I think that it might be a lot longer of a tail to build some of this and to have some of the capital pushed towards it and the network effects around it. But I do think that one of the things that I think I got a lot deeper into was just like free banking theory and what that looks like. And then there's the Hal Finney vision around how all of this would scale. And a lot of these ideas of like, you know, having layers with unilateral exit, I don't think that was something that was really being surmised at the time in the early years of Bitcoin. And that's something now that has become like, we're stepping it up and we're saying, no, we can still maintain these properties. We don't have to necessarily have these trade-offs. So that's really cool. But I actually got a lot more comfortable with the free banking vision. And I started writing a lot more about that because there's a million things I could talk about with if Bitcoin scales from like a system of like competitive free market banks, and what that looks like and what the history of that ultimately was. I think like the common thread across all of it is that like this decentralization idea that everybody wants to talk about with how we have trust trade-offs, that changes with the scope of your perspective. So something can be highly decentralized if it's a very competitive free market. So if we might say, okay, so like any individual node has certain centralized trust trade-offs. But if you expand your scope and you look at the market as a whole, and there's, you know, billions of nodes around the world, and they're all competing with the alignment of incentives, well, now we have a market that's hyper-competitive and aligned to produce results for like individual nodes in like the right way. It doesn't mean it's perfect. It means that, you know, just like any free market, people will get burned, and that's a price you pay to ultimately have markets. But
how important is it in your opinion to have like these layer twos and other scaling solutions be that they are decentralized? So like the way I view it is like as long as the base layer is decentralized, like the decentralization as I see it is a somewhat unfortunate means to a much greater end, which is the finite supply and the damn near perfect money. But we only need it because human beings can't resist using money printers if they get their hands on one.
Yeah.
So like that's where we, as long as the nodes are in charge of this thing, then that's secure. It's when you miners or developers or big companies in Bitcoin, when they can influence what happens with Bitcoin, that's not optimal. Like we want the users to be in charge. Like, what's your view on that?
Yeah, completely. At the L1 level, everything needs to be as decentralized as possible. And that's a fundamental priority with like miner centralization. I kind of view that as one of like the primary risks that we should be considering within the L1 ecosystem. For like the question around L2s, really what it boils down to is at this point, we just don't know what we don't know. When people talk about ETF adoption or paper Bitcoin companies and, you know, this proliferation of Bitcoin moving into like effectively, you know, centralized forms of control that are easily censorable or seizable by a government in some way, shape, or form. It's really not that, it's material, but it's not some sort of systemic risk or anything at this point. It doesn't seem like it's trending to become that. But nonetheless, it's a similar form of argument. Like, what's the risk? Why do we want to have other layers that allow us to capture the properties of the L1 in some way, shape, or form? And all that means is that if you can move and take your Bitcoin and you can lock it into some other protocol that allows you to exit that protocol and get your Bitcoin in worst case scenario, then that allows you to maintain the properties of the L1, of the scarcity, because you can always come back and get the real Bitcoin on the L1. So that's valuable by being able to maintain it. If you were to instead not lock your Bitcoin into another protocol, if you were to lock your or give your Bitcoin to a centralized custodian of some form, then you don't have a guarantee that you can get back the L1 Bitcoin. And then because you don't have that guarantee, then you are ultimately losing some of the properties of the L1. You don't have a guarantee that you do have finite supply and all of this. So like, that's kind of the primary question is, how much will those guarantees matter? And those guarantees will matter if we assume a hypothetical scenario where some large proportion of Bitcoin moves into large forms of centralized control where individuals who want to get their Bitcoin, real Bitcoin back, are not able to for some reason. So it's one of those risks, right? Where it's, we don't always know, we can conceive of it. It seems like a real risk. It seems like there's incentives for that are aligned for it to emerge as a greater risk over time. Similar to like quantum, it's one of these risks where people are just like, we don't really know. You know, it could happen, but we don't really know. And it's just, so there's things like that where it's going to be thinking about, it's going to be building towards. It's not some sort of like major issue or anything that I think needs to be addressed overnight. But nonetheless, it's something where there are certainly benefits to us being able to like guarantee that it won't happen in the future.
Yeah. But how do you guarantee something on a system that is totally dependent on its users? Very hard to guarantee anything. Like, it's like the whole ossification debate. Like, how would you ever know? Theoretically, Bitcoin can never ossify because it's not backed by energy. It's backed by human beings doing stuff or not doing stuff.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Because that's something that I think right now we're witnessing the different stakeholder groups within Bitcoin and how consensus is ultimately achieved is something that I think we're going to look back on in history is one of the most interesting case studies of value that exists, because we none of us understand it yet. Like, everybody's putting out arguments. People have much better understandings than others, I think, but like in my book, I tried to put out a framework for how to think of different stakeholder groups within Bitcoin in one chapter and what their incentives are and, you know, how they're kind of like, I describe them as like, you know, like a transitive system of checks and balances where like one group, it's like rock, paper, scissors, you know, paper beats rock, rock beats scissors, and, you know, what is it? Paper, scissors beats paper. And it's kind of like that. There's kind of a dynamic happening between the different groups, and that's one of the components that makes incentives align really well within Bitcoin. So then when we say that, like, incentives are aligned really well, it's that's just this social layer, this experiment that we're all witnessing, and it's worked for 15 years, and it's worked exceptionally well to the tune of, you know, like the best investment measurable history. So like, that's cool. Like, we're all still learning about it. And that's wild. It's something that's really captivating. One thing I'll reference is a paper that Lynn Alden and Steve Lee put out. I didn't finish all of it, and I need to, but I think anybody who's more curious about this topic should read that as a starting point.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we tell people to not to custody their own coins all the time. Like, we want as many Bitcoins as possible in the hands of individuals rather than institutions.
Yeah.
And everyone always says you shouldn't buy your coins off of a KYC exchange, but I think it's even more critical to not sell them to a KYC exchange.
Right.
But because they're bound to end up in hands you don't necessarily want them to end up in.
Right. Like, right.
Well, on the other hand, though, who cares? Like, you know, like, I don't care who else holds Bitcoin. Right, like hands who I don't want to end up in. Like,
I don't want them to. Like, I'd rather have them in the hands of individuals than these ETFs and big companies.
Yeah,
just because then you know that they're in the hands of someone who cares more than someone who has a stake in a pension fund somewhere. I think that's a noble goal. If not anything else,
I don't disagree. But still, you have no control over it. I mean, I'm not invalidating your point, though. I mean, it's us as Bitcoiners. I think if you're deeper in and you know how to find another Bitcoiner who maybe needs some cash or whatever it is, like that's good. Or these peer-to-peer exchanges and stuff.
I mean, the end game is that people actually use the system for what it's for, and there's no exchanges at all. We just use Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That has to be the angle.
Great news. The Bitcoin Infinity Show has a new lead sponsor. This is BitVault, a new multi-sig wallet that lets you not only put Bitcoins into cold storage, but into super duper polar bear meat in your freezer type cold storage using the time lock function. This protects against $15 wrench attacks because the attacker doesn't know that you have this thing running in the background. So you can just secretly take back your Bitcoins while the attacker thinks he got it, sort of. So go to bitvault.sv to find out more. You can use code Infinity for a 10% discount. They have a pre-sale here that's still in beta, but you can get a lifetime deal for $199. This is 100% open source, 100% non-custodial, and there's zero counterparty risk. So what are you waiting for? Check out bitvault.sv right now. And speaking of private keys, you should, of course, take control of your private keys. And you do that by getting yourself a good old hardware wallet. And our favorite is the BitBox. And they have a new edition called the BitBox O2 Nova. The BitBox O2 Nova has a tempered glass display, which is new and shiny. It has next level security because they have the latest security chip installed. And now it works directly with iOS. So you can plug it into your iPhone or your iPad directly. And it will work perfectly for you. It works on all other devices as well, Windows, Linux, Commodore 64, whatever. So go to bitbox.swiss and get a Nova right now. Use code Infinity for 5% off. And if all this responsibility sounds a little too much for you, we have a perfect service to recommend. And that is the bitcoinadvisor.com. These are nice fellows from down under, and they can help you with Bitcoin inheritance planning. It's a collaborative custody solution where you're still 100% in control. Go to the bitcoinadvisor.com to check them out. And I think you can use code Infinity there too. All right, back to the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Two interesting points about that. I think like heat reuse applications are going to be really interesting for
what,
like
application?
Just like heat reuse. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and we have, we started the space out there as our Bitcoin Citadel. One of the guy who runs it, Tyler Stevens, started this whole like heat punk movement around heat reuse applications. I was just talking with the founder of the company Sunbit out here, which is really interesting. They seem to have made a lot of progress with it, but it's just the logic of there are all of these situations around the world where people are plugging into some source of energy in their homes, or companies are doing this in their warehouses or in all of these other places where they need to produce heat just for the sake of producing heat. And Bitcoin miners produce heat, and it consumes the exact same amount of energy to produce it through a Bitcoin miner that it would to just produce it without using a Bitcoin miner. Therefore, you might as well get Bitcoin while you're producing heat.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of challenges in terms of actually executing this because it's a really big vision, but the idea is that like everybody's water heater in their home can mine Bitcoin over time. I think when it comes to like decentralizing the network and for people to all own their own Bitcoin without having to go through an on-ramp, that's a natural market incentive that could create highly, highly distributed forms of Bitcoin acquisition globally over time. Like that's something that's really interesting to me. I'm forgetting the second point I wanted to make. What were you saying in response to Knut?
Almost just that it kind of doesn't matter where the Bitcoin ends up if you're selling it. Like I don't have to care, but that was like even like a total side thing, you know.
You don't have to, but you can.
Yeah. But maybe the other thing was.
I think that brought it back to me. Like the question about like, because you were making the point. You're just like, you know, we can't force other people to do things, right? And it's definitely true. But the way that I view all of this is in terms of, okay, so it's similar to how we would think about a society, right? We can't force, we don't want to. Some people believe they can, and they take the people who, have a monopoly on violence and try to implement it through force and try to vote that into existence, at least in the US. But people have some sort of belief that here's what everybody should do. And there's different ways that you could influence that. Like number one, you can be the change that you want to see in the world, and you can try to educate and you can have that happen. I think number two is that you can build tools that make it easier for people to do that. Like one of the fundamental kind of like economic variables that I try to look at and I try to define in some of my writing when I talk about like what makes something systemically more decentralized over time or creates more nodes within any sort of network is if the marginal cost of participating in that network remains persistently low relative to alternatives. That's kind of the number one thing that I think creates decentralization within any network.
That's why that's so crucial. And that's why we're so vehemently against BAM, because we don't want to make the costliness of starting up a new node go up too fast.
And it's like, what's the, so like, and we've applied that to like node infrastructure, and you can apply that to any mode of thinking. And it's, if you want something to be, so to your point of like, we can't control other people's behavior, but we can create technologies that might make it so that the market is more competitive, and then their behavior might change because of that.
This ties back to the water heater or the heating thing. We talked a lot about this in Slovenia. We were at the mining conference last year there. And was it, what's he called? Obi-Wan? No, Kenobi. He's called Kenobi. had this theory that in the future, Bitcoin miners will have to do something else with that excess energy than just mine Bitcoin, because the competitiveness is just, it's already super hard to be profitable as a miner, especially smaller operations, because you can't leverage the fiat bullshit that you can if you're super big. But if, as you say, if you can heat your water heater with it, then that becomes the way for miners to stay profitable, and that, as you say, that increases the decentralization of mining by a lot.
Yep.
And that's all super positive, I think. So
exactly. Because like, that's a system where applying the principle I was just mentioning, the marginal cost of participating in mining is zero. You're already using this for some other purpose in your life. So the economic cost for you to mine the Bitcoin is effectively zero at that point, because everything's being offset by the utility you gain from the alternative function. So that just means that all we need is to build the technologies. And now it's like, if you're against like larger miners and all of that, I would say look into building heat reuse applications and stranded energy acquisition and all of these other variables that are alternatives to that.
Well, and this is like a huge theme at this conference here, BTC Hell. And I mean, this is because Finland has really figured this out, basically.
It's cold up here.
It's cold up here. Yeah, totally. And the heat reuse thing, it's not even just like water boilers in individual houses. The cities have their own district heating system. And so even year round, they use that to heat water for everywhere. So even in the summer when it's kind of warm, like we had a heat wave for a month here, they still need to heat up hot water. So the Bitcoin miners can run year round.
It wasn't really a heat wave then. It was a Finnish heat wave.
Sure. Well, but like people don't really have air conditioning so much here, and nights can get pretty warm and stuff. But yeah, exactly. So it's... And so I think it's great that there's more discussion about this and more companies, as you said, SunBit, 21 Energy also is really big in that here.
I think there's a HeatBit up in Canada. Yeah.
We had Maximilian from 21 Energy on the pod just a couple of months ago,
but we just released it.
A couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And that was really interesting. And you already have one of his heaters. Yep. Or their heaters, and I'm getting one after this. Fingers crossed, but I'm going to totally have good use for that in Spain, because the houses aren't insulated, so the winters can get pretty cold inside.
Yep.
So we have ACs, but we don't have heaters, and here's the other way around.
Exactly. Well, and the other thing about Spain is that's the case study in like why the demand response use case for mining is so important. Like their grid just completely got shot. Kenobi is doing his presentation at BTCL is about that. Fantastic. Actually, the case study of this
looking
massive blackout.
To that. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like
go renewables.
So are you involved like a lot in mining and startups in the mining space, or what do you kind of tend to focus on?
I guess we've the only investment that we've done in mining so far is Gridless.
Obviously, we unfortunately couldn't get the logistics work to get Eric over here at Kersman, but
he's gonna be out here.
No, he isn't.
He's actually coming to the space in a couple weeks out in the U.S. So he's gonna be in Denver.
It's awesome.
He's great.
So what they're doing is really really interesting, and The arguments like they're finding economics that are arguably like the cheapest in the world for stranded energy down in Africa. And the question's kind of like, okay, so when people talk like the scarcity of block space, and Bob Burnett's talked all about this, right? Where block space is going to become more scarce over time. It's going to be kind of viewed almost as like a separate resource. And as it becomes more scarce, it's going to become this really valuable thing, and Bitcoin miners are going to be put in a position where, they're going to have influence over who has access to block space. And the question becomes, what I think will be really valuable. It's like, okay, so what does that mean? It means that you just have an operation built up that allows you to, guess a hash effectively, more rapidly than other people on some sort of probability. And that gives you the option to give transactions to individuals within block space. And there's a market kind of determining how this all works. So if that's the case, then it's like, what's the core resource, right? Like, if you're mining gold, for example, the core resources you own the land from which you're mining, or you have legal agreements supporting your leasing of the land while you're mining it, you have actual... you will have that access to that resource that gives you the ability to extract it. So like, what is it that really allows you to do that? I think at like first blush, people would think the mining hardware, but mining hardware depreciates really quickly. It's not really the crux of it. I think like if markets are really dynamic, so if we assume a world where it's highly mature, block space is filled, energy production is happening all over the world that's supporting the Bitcoin mining network and, a much larger scale than it is today. Where is it all going to wash out in that highly competitive environment? It's already competitive today. It's going to get much more competitive. And if you look at miners that are, targeting somewhere between like 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour in most situations, but for some of these stranded energy applications, they can get closer to like 1 cent per kilowatt hour. And it's like, okay, the majority of hash rate's going to be coming from the stranded energy market at some point. So then the question becomes, if that's the case, owning stranded energy assets might be like one of the most valuable resources in the world. And how can you get that? And that's kind of what I think Gridless is moving into right now, is like a really competitive positioning.
I'd say it can even go negative. If you have a wind farm, for instance, when the wind is... too harsh, like too strong, mm-hmm. and as it works now, they break the whole thing, like put a brake on it and mm-hmm. don't let it spin at all. Mm. And with Bitcoin miners attached, you could just like, I guess you could have them running in the stronger winds, and thereby reducing the cost of this,
right?
Pulling the handbrake thing. So yeah, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And just how it actually incentivizes this stuff and is actually fixing the problem.
Yep.
And the media has mainstream media has sort of changed its tune somewhat.
Yeah.
They still don't get the bigger thing, that it fixes resource misallocation through sound money, but they are catching on to the whole mining might not be such a bad thing after all.
Say. Totally. In the less trusting aspect of my mind is kind of views that for more that, the new technology that's been proliferating, that prior to it occurring, Bitcoin mining was the only way to leverage this form of energy. But AI compute now can do a very similar thing. So that's something that's great for these stranded energy miners, because it gives them access to another revenue stream. It de-risks the business a bit more to have multiple revenue streams, particularly when you look at the cyclicality of Bitcoin mining over time during bear markets and how that can impact the business, whereas AI compute might be a bit more steady for them over time. Having both dynamics will be really good. And that's going to significantly increase the demand for stranded energy assets over time as well. So it's all of a sudden AI comes out and they're doing the same thing. And now the media is good.
One thing, and that is the bandwidth. They need a lot more bandwidth.
True. Yeah. This is true. Yeah. Yeah. So the telecoms are going to benefit from a lot more fiber optic getting built out probably too.
Yeah. 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 Still If you don't, if you put Bitcoin miners there, you don't need the bandwidth. You can telegraph the correct hash every 10 minutes.
And do you know if it's also the same level of quality demand response? Because if you shut off the AI compute, you actually shut off the thing that is providing the value, as opposed to the proof of work mechanism, right?
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, I don't think any of this stuff's been worked out, but no, I doubt it. Right?
Intuitively, right? Yeah, like again, I haven't done the math on it, but I think it's at least less good. Like data centers are less good at the flexible load property.
Right, yeah, right, yeah, because miners is just a switch. Like you can just shut them off one by one.
Fascinating. What else are you kind of most interested in the space right now? Like what's getting you excited?
So we just put out this big report. It's kind of interesting how I would frame it. So we put out this massive report we've been working on this year, and like in the US, bank adoption for Bitcoin is going to change very significantly. And it was at the beginning, the Trump administration entered, and at the beginning of the year, SAB 121, which was a ruling that was put in by Gary Gensler under the SEC during the Biden administration, that was effectively telling banks, if you are going to hold Bitcoin or some other, you know, digital asset on your balance sheet, then that needs to be reported as a liability, which is not really how you would treat any other, like effectively like customer deposit at a bank. Normally a customer deposit is like an off balance sheet item. And why that's important is that all these banks are regulated, and there's certain ratios and risk metrics and things that they need to fall under. And if they were to start doing this, it's going to impact whether or not they're in compliance with all these regulatory variables if they start increasing liabilities on their balance sheet. So it basically meant that digital assets were like a non-starter for banks in the US. And then we had, you know, like Caitlin Long, who's fighting and, you know, doing all this heavy lifting and paying lawyers a ton of money to try to fight all of that. And then Trump entered and they repealed that ruling. And it's like, okay, so this is a game changer. Banks are going to all start getting involved. And we wanted to be like, okay, so how is that going to happen? There's a lot of people like banks are coming and all of that, but we wanted to create a very technical and comprehensive report that really understands like, here's actually how the system works. So we teamed up with the CTO of Silvergate, who built like the SEN network, which was creating all the settlement amongst like exchanges effectively on their dollar legs. You know, they kind of, they're the most like technology forward bank basically within this industry. They're supporting all the firms that were doing it until ChokePoint took them down. And we teamed up with him and we did like a really technical report, which is cool because, you know, it was really because we want to understand where all this is going and how it impacts Bitcoin, right? And what the good things are and what the bad things are. So that's kind of the goal, is for us to identify all of that. And then we have very technical areas that really show like, here's what a bank's architecture looks like. And if you are founders that are trying to get Bitcoin involved in what they're doing, here's how you can build technologies that'll streamline that so they can do it in a better way. So those were kind of the main things we looked at. I think to your question, like what was most exciting about all of it? I think the biggest thing is putting the time to think through the game theory of what's going to happen with banks, stablecoins, and Bitcoin over time. Stablecoins have proliferated. People realize that using a cryptographic signature as a means of exchange is a standard everybody's converging upon. And that's, you know, increasing the, effectively like the fungibility across all of it, because we're settling in a similar, we're using digital signatures to represent value. And so the stablecoin proliferation is just giving more access, because that standard is much better than all of the current standards today. And stablecoins have been expanding for a different reason. So the question is like, well, what happens with Bitcoin and all of this? And basically, well, one big part of the paper I do is I kind of have this section of like, here's kind of our predictions around what's going to happen with Bitcoin and banks and where that's going to lead to. And we walk through the game theory on stablecoins. And basically what's happening is that we have this banking system, like the common term that you'll hear is that it's a two-tier banking system, right? We have central banks in tier one We have commercial banks in tier two, and it's this whole fiat construct and it doesn't make any sense and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So these two tiers interact with effectively the U.S. Treasury Department, right? So like U.S. debt gets issued and central banks buy that. They create reserves within the central bank. And then those reserves are ultimately placed into the commercial banks and used as a base for lending, which doesn't really exist anymore. Since like the 2020 pandemic, they don't require reserves to really lend anymore. But like structurally, that's kind of how it's integrated. And then the commercial banks make loans and that pushes money into existence. And then ultimately, there's fintechs that interact with all of that. So there's all these different intermediaries from the process of U.S. debt gets created and it gets monetized into our system and it gets used effectively as money. And then we call it like the relationship between the dollar and U.S. debt is no different. You know, that's what money's not backed by anything, right? And it's kind of the same thing. The difference is that dollars are considered more fungible than U.S. debt is. All debt is different, right? You have different maturities and you have different interest rates and different vintages from when it was released. So the dollar is kind of like a fundamental, it's blending, you know, all these different forms of debt together, which are all backing it somewhere in the system, right? So what happened with stablecoins? Stablecoins are going straight to the source now. Stablecoins are saying, we're going to buy debt and we're putting it behind a stablecoin. And that's like cutting out the rest of the system right now. It's cutting out central banks. It's cutting out the commercial banks. And the Genius Act, when it passed in the US to give a regulatory framework for stablecoins, that act is, it's just a regulatory carve out to try to protect the banks is all it's doing. It's saying stablecoins, you guys can't pay interest to people, only banks. And banks are going to issue their new like CBDC like stablecoins called tokenized reserve deposits. Our acronym for those in the paper is TURDS. And so we're proud of coining that. And then you're going to have like new like wholesale CBDCs that are issued by, you know, they're not going to happen in the US, but the wholesale CBDC that's going to be issued is going to be that TURD, tokenized reserve deposit. And then like the commercial banks, when they issue them directly, as opposed to the central bank issuing it directly, they're going to be issuing a tokenized deposit. So like those will be the new words for CBDC. And those are going to pay interest. That's the difference is banks have a special license to pay interest on those from their depositors and stablecoins will not be able to do that. So that's happening in the US right now. But like right now, stablecoins would have the ability like Tether has a very strong ability to pay interest. Effectively, what does that mean? All they're doing is we're trading US debt. What's cool is that Tether also has Bitcoin in the reserves. So what's happening with stablecoins is they're cutting out this whole system. There's regulations that are going into place to still try to protect banks because of the banking cartel. And what stablecoins are doing is they're basically creating a token that's like blending the US debt in the same way the dollar does by having a bunch of different maturities and a bunch of different vintages. And it's making it more fungible. One stablecoin is representing one and the market kind of determines that based on how they're reserving the thing. And we have kind of like this new banking system kind of emerging around that. So that's all to say that how does a game theory play out? Well, we're going to have a whole offshore market that emerges for these stable coins because now that we have regulations in the US, those regulations are saying you can only use short-term government debt and you can't pay interest if you're issuing a stable coin. It's going to make them a lot less sexy to people. What's going to be sexy is the offshore market. And that's going to be like, we're paying interest and you can reserve with what you want to reserve and a competitive market's going to determine what that is. And you don't have to like, you know, deal with all this banking cartel bullshit. So that's going to emerge. And whether it emerges directly for dollars or for other currencies, we're going to start to witness that play out with stablecoins. And what are they going to be competing on? What do we know from participating in all of these like fiat games that have emerged in like broader crypto? Yield. Everybody wants some sort of yield. So like the interest that these are going to be paying, just like any capital market, right, is the marginal buyers and sellers are going to be determined by which stablecoin is paying what interest rate at what time, and then what are the risks viewed on the reserves of the stablecoin. So I think like over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see this offshore market emerge, and the US might come into terms with that once they realize that's where a lot of the demand is going. But we're going to see this market of tokens that are backed by reserves of debts of various governments. And they're going to be paying interest to people. And that's how they're going to compete against one another. Because there is not going to be the same hold on this system that they're capable of having on the current banking system. You know, it took them a century to be able to get that amount of control over the banking system. So now we got a new one that they're going to have to try to control. So what's going to happen with that? The biggest thing is that when you're competing on the interest rate, it's going to come down to what are you reserving it with? So if we look at how Tether is reserving Tether today, 5% of their reserves are in Bitcoin. And Tether is like arguably the most profitable company in the world right now because they don't have to pay the interest out yet because the market's just not competitive enough to require them to. So they basically just get to keep the money. But if Tether was paying out interest, it could be paying a lot of interest for everybody that's holding the stable coins. And that 5% Bitcoin reserve, I think, is going to become a really key thing. When people say like stable coins are like a Trojan horse for Bitcoin, it's like, what are they doing? They're putting the world on infrastructure that's going to be transacting in cryptographic signatures. So that's big. And then they're going to create an incentive where the token that's paying the best interest is going to be the token that's reserved most competitively. What's going to be the best reserve? Bitcoin. Bitcoin. And so what's Michael Saylor doing right now?
Yeah, that's basically what he's issuing. His stock is that kind of token.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they're just doing it on rails that you can actually trade it with, as opposed to like a brokerage account for somebody. But the economics of what he's structuring, that's going to be like the end state that happens with all these things. So stable coins are going to be basically co-opting like a Saylor strategy over time. And that's going to create a ton of demand for Bitcoin. And then everybody's going to be sitting here. And what is that going to do? It's going to jack up the price of Bitcoin. Bitcoin's going to be trading at 20 trillion market cap, whatever it is. It's going to be significantly less volatile. It's going to be much more mature. And everybody's going to say, well, why the fuck are we trading in stable coins? Just trade in Bitcoin. And like, that's like what I'm excited about thinking through how all this works is that that's the game theory that leads us to Bitcoin adoption in the way that the market currently works today and how institutions and governments think.
Yeah, and Tether's 5% reserve will all of a sudden be 50% reserve simply because of the increase in value.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just going to be like, all of the other stablecoins who aren't using Bitcoin reserves are going to say, we can't compete with the guys who have 20% Bitcoin reserves. We need to do it. And people are going to keep jacking it up.
What was that figure I heard when the whole MicroStrategy strategy was explained to me? That like 40, 45% per year? Like the median, the average increase in Bitcoin's price per year.
Yeah.
Over its entire lifespan.
Yeah, I think it's like if you go all the way back to the beginning, but then it's like pretty skewed because from the 0 to 1,000 is obviously really rapid. But I think it's like if you go back to the beginning, it's closer to like 70 or 80% so far over time. But yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if you just weigh in the total market cap of gold, we still have a very long way to go upwards.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is too, is that as that happens, gold is going to be also going up in value. So gold's around 22 trillion market cap in total today. In this banking report, we actually do like a big market sizing on the value of gold. The thing you have to carve out for is that like the value of the jewelry market, which is about 40%. But that market actually surprised me. I didn't realize it was that big. But some of that is, you know, monetary, right? It's hard to say how much. Yeah. But regardless, there's some amount of that that is less than the total market cap. It'll probably be like the addressable one for Bitcoin.
That's so interesting because like the jewelry use case is something that makes gold worse as a form of money.
Yeah, totally.
So it's their spam. Right? Yeah, making right, earrings. Right.
Yeah. That's a good way of making the analogy. Yeah. Never really thought about it that way.
And the funny thing is you don't know what the extent of the jewelry market is actually for money or not, because you have Indians who wear like 6 gold rings and have chains and like literally and like they wear their gold, and the point is not to like have nice jewelry. That's their money, their store of value, right? And so it's something in the middle of the jewelry market is partially monetary also, right? So that just screws it all up
for hip hoppers and stuff.
That probably is spam. That's gold spam.
But yeah, so like I think that by the time Bitcoin is consuming that market, the value of that gold, it's hard to describe all this because it's all dynamic, but like By the time Bitcoin has consumed the gold market, like the theoretical market cap of gold, I think it'll be twice what it is right now. It'll be like 40 trillion because store value assets are just going to be so much more in demand at that point. We've watched it go up so much over the past year, you know, or past like 5 years. I think the market cap of gold has doubled.
But that's denominated in dollars. Denominated in Bitcoins is not going to go up. It's going to be smaller.
Exactly. It's going to be smaller denominated in Bitcoin. Yeah.
And the jewelry part of it is going to grow bigger in comparison to the entire use
to the rest
case.
Of yeah, it. Yeah. We're going to Which consume all the other part of it.
So we're finally getting reasonably priced jewelry, or at least more honestly priced.
Well, yeah. So there's going to be a huge value opportunity in the jewelry market in like 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
Well, and like if we play this out all the way to the end, because we tend to like to do that, didn't River actually basically try to sort this out and basically came to the conclusion that Bitcoin is going to probably hit half of the store of value market ever? Like that's kind of the main thing. Like that's the wrong term, but their whole thing was that it was 50% of like value. And Saylor is actually saying the same thing. Like, so multiple people are saying the same thing, that it's like Bitcoin is going to be the full half of the ledger, really. Like when Bitcoin has eaten the entire store value market, that's probably what I was getting at, that stuff still happening is going to be the other side of things that people invest in, like real world things. Not to say that Bitcoin isn't real world, but then the value reflection of Bitcoin is going to basically be that full other side of the coin.
Yeah, I think the way that I've always thought about this is, so depending on the success Bitcoin ultimately has, right? If Bitcoin does achieve the goal of, you know, neutral monetary system, freedom money for the world, and it consumes the entire market for money, I think the total addressable market under that scenario is a question of what is going to be the proportion of credit that exists in that type of an economy. If we have a deflationary monetary system, technology is doing what technology is doing, what does the credit market look like? You know, today the credit market is the entire market of money. On a Bitcoin standard, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 20%. You know, we don't really know. I've written a lot on like how to theoretically think about some of it. But like, that's kind of like the competing form of money for the market in Bitcoin that'll exist at that point.
I mean, that's impossible to quantify because there are so many variables here. Like, Bitcoiners tend to adopt a lower time preference, meaning that's part of the journey, right? Meaning that instead of, you know, borrowing for a Lambo, We walk around in a robe and drive a Toyota and have our stacks for 10 years, and then we don't need a mortgage anymore.
So that
whole process and weighing that in, it's impossible. Like,
exactly. Yeah. And then like, how much productivity is going to be unleashed from all of this?
Yeah.
And how much more valuable will these markets actually be when they're not comprised of, like, you know, in the media sector isn't being based off like reality TV and Kardashians and all of this stuff. And it's, you know, that's actually time that people are spending doing things that people want.
I think Jeff Booth had a figure on the Nikos pod on Simply, $43 million per coin if we just take all the money in the world and denominate it in Bitcoin today. Which is...
I am really critical of a lot of the like bottom-up modeling of this stuff, just because like all these markets are dynamic. I think it's really easy to do if we take like a very simple approach of like store of, not easy, but like we could probably get within a reasonable range if we're saying Bitcoin's going to take some proportion of the store value market only. Like, if you have that line of reasoning, and that means it effectively just becomes like a digital gold, then you could probably get reasonably close to what that market size would look like. But outside of that, it's just when Bitcoin becomes the unit of account, then it's impossible to, you know, it's just going to be everything. And you won't give a shit what that number is.
You're just measuring purchasing power at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how long do you think it's going to take to hit that 20 trillion market cap? I don't know if you've thought about that, which spoiler alert for if my quick math is right, that's a million a coin, give or take.
Yeah. Yeah. So like a million a coin, I think we get to a million a coin by like 2030.
Love it.
Why so bearish?
Yeah, I know. I have to be reasonable as an investor.
See, I love that. Yeah, that's the reasonable take.
yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I mean, who knows though? It's going to be wild when we have a million dollar candle around that at some point.
And if money printer keeps going at an ever accelerating rate, so does the number go up.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But we're not getting as much purchasing power and et cetera, et cetera. But,
no, you know. But still a million a coin. We're not using the same yardstick there, but
no, exactly.
We fucked up to the yardstick, which is not a yardstick.
Yeah.
Yeah, where can people find you online? Where is like...
check out our new report. So our website for my venture fund is epochvc.io. That's EPOCHVC.io. And then you follow me on Twitter and Oster. It's just my name, at Eric Yakes. And yeah, that's all my shilling.
Good. Eric, thanks very much for coming on.
It was a pleasure, lads. Yeah.
Let's make this the first time of many, you know?
Of course. Yeah. On my next trip out to Helsinki.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. We do have the internet as well, but, you know, yeah, it's always better in person. I'm glad we got the chance to do this.
Likewise.
Yeah. Thanks again for coming all this way, and hope you enjoy the conference over the next couple of days. And
There's a ton of hype. I'm excited.
Yeah, us too. Definitely.
Absolutely. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Show. Like, subscribe, brush your teeth, and cheerio.
I guess that's how we're ending it. Eric, thanks again.
Thank you.
Cool.